From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. There's more rain in the forecast, but no tap water yet in Des Moines. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Dennis Ryerson, editorial page editor of the Des Moines Register, about Des Moines' soaked spirits and the challenges of getting out the paper during the flood. Later, the making of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and other tales of Hollywood, we talk with film director Richard Fleischer. His father was the great animator Max Fleischer, the creator of Betty Boop and Popeye cartoons. And book critic John Leonard reviews The 60s, a collection of essays by Edmund Wilson from 1960 to 1972. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The economic impact of the flooding in the Midwest is making itself felt across an ever-widening area. Transportation Secretary Federico Peña said the floods have disrupted grain shipments to the West Coast, where grain ships would normally take it overseas. He said the disaster has also affected deliveries of auto parts to assembly plants. The flood is now blamed in at least 33 deaths. It's caused $10 billion in damage, swamped 16,000 square miles of farmland, and damaged more than 22,000 homes. The forecast is for continued rain in many parts of the disaster area. A group of Republican and Democratic congressmen urged President Clinton today to pay for the $3 billion flood relief package by cutting other government programs. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
Most of the 15 congressmen are from states affected by the floods, so they made it perfectly clear that they fully support the federal aid President Clinton has asked Congress to authorize. Congressman Tim Penny is a Democrat from Minnesota.
The question is whether we can pay for this disaster aid. And clearly, in a $1.5 trillion budget, there ought to be enough money available to shift for this emergency purpose.
Penny and the other members of Congress have come up with $3 billion worth of suggested cuts in other government programs that they say would pay for the flood relief package. But a Congressional Rules Committee is unlikely to allow a vote on the proposed cuts. Right now, Congress and the President seem more concerned about how to get the flood aid to the Midwest as quickly as possible, not necessarily how the government is going to pay for it. This is Eric Weiner in Washington.
The Clinton administration is calling for an increase in the gas tax in order to pay for some of the spending programs it wants to include in the deficit reduction bill. Administration officials briefed House Democrats on the plan today. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
President Clinton wants to give China a year to improve its human rights policies and says the U.S. should continue to grant Beijing most favored nation trade status, or MFN, in the meantime. On an overwhelming 305 to 118 vote, the House decided to go along with that approach. Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Democrat Lee Hamilton of Indiana said the human rights situation in China is getting better.
Human freedom in China is expanding today, not contracting, and that revoking MFN would lead to more political control in China, not less.
Congress has voted to revoke the preferred trade status for China in each of the last 3 years, only to see their efforts vetoed by President Bush. But now many Democrats say lifting MFN would only undercut China's reformers. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 10.6 points to close at a record 3,555. This is NPR News. President Clinton is mourning the death of a longtime friend and White House aide who apparently committed suicide yesterday. Police found the body of Vincent Foster last night in a Virginia park just across the Potomac River from Washington. He was dead of an apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound. Foster grew up with President Clinton in Hope, Arkansas, and was later a law partner of Hillary Rodham Clinton in Little Rock. He served as deputy White House legal counsel and was involved in several controversial decisions, including the ouster of 7 employees from the White House travel office. The Food and Drug Administration is changing its rules to include more women in the testing of experimental drugs. NPR's Joe Palca has details.
Since 1977, FDA rules have excluded women capable of bearing children from participating in safety studies of drugs. The idea was to avoid the possibility of exposing a fetus to a potentially harmful substance. But in recent years, FDA has begun to rethink those rules. As long as they were informed of the risk, women should be allowed to choose to participate. In addition, by excluding women from early safety studies, researchers might miss possible differences in the way men and women react to a particular drug. Last April, the agency announced it was going to change its guidelines, and those changes will be formally published in tomorrow's Federal Register. The new rules will allow women of childbearing age to participate in trials, and they encourage drug companies to pay particular attention to the way new drugs may affect men and women differently. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca reporting.
The UN Security Council decided today to maintain the nearly three-year-old economic embargo against Iraq. The council said that Iraq has still not complied fully with the 1991 Gulf War ceasefire resolutions. The key issues include an end to human rights abuses and acceptance of the redrawn border with Kuwait. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Thunderstorms are predicted through the weekend in Des Moines, where people are getting through another day without tap water. The city's main water purification plant was flooded out a week and a half ago. Even after running water is restored, it will likely take a few more weeks until it is drinkable. Earlier today, we phoned Dennis Ryerson, editorial page editor of the Des Moines Register. I asked him if things are any better or worse today in Des Moines.
They're about the same, and in some respects a little worse. And I think they're worse psychically more than anything else. We learned at 6 o'clock this morning that the water system is not being recharged at the pace that they had hoped. Some reason at 3 o'clock in the morning, they lost pressure. They don't know if it was because of a water main break or whatever. But that means essentially that the downtown area won't be back on service until tomorrow at the earliest. And some areas of the city won't be served with water until the weekend.
So has anybody gotten water yet?
Nobody has water. They're trying to provide water to the water main so they can provide water for the hydrants in case they have a fire problem. They want to make sure that everybody all over town has equal fire protection. So that's why they want to get the whole system recharged before they give anybody permission to turn on the valves in their homes or businesses. But they're just having more of a problem putting the water back into the system, which means that for many workers, you don't have air conditioning. For people in homes, you still have water for bathing, for washing clothes, for washing dishes. You have to go to one of 80 or 90 water distribution points around the city to get water for drinking. And even then, you have to boil what you get because the containers aren't foolproof in terms of their contamination. It's just a real headache, and it's going to continue. And I said it was a kind of a psychic low today because people have been so desperately waiting and hoping for some good news. Mm-hmm. And we hoped today to get the good news that the downtown area would be the first area to be receiving water, and yet it's going to be another day. So I think people are really getting weary over this whole thing.
How have you been getting by without running water?
Me personally?
Yeah.
I've been going to one of the distribution points and picking up water. I have a camp shower system that I use. It's an H2O bag that you normally hook up to a tree. I'm lucky. I've got a little stream that runs outside my house. So I go out to the stream, get a bucket of water, and I've got a little camp pump purifier, and I can get enough fairly clean water to take a shower with that. It takes me about 45 minutes for the whole process from beginning to end. It's a hassle. But I'm able to get through, and I'm also able to flush my toilets with that water. Other people don't have that luxury. Who would have thought a stream beside your house would have been thought of as a luxury in terms of a water supply? But I've got it, and other people don't. The worst part is just dealing with it's unsanitary. You can't clean your house as much. You have to make sure water is boiled before you drink it. It just takes, it's longer to go through normal life processes. And then when you get to work, in our newsroom, it's easily into the 90s. They've got fans all over the place. They've taken out windows that had been sealed. One of them broke in the process of taking it out to try and provide fresh air. The company brings in refreshments, water, food, cold drinks, things like that, and those are very much appreciated. But it's still drudgery to work in an office where it's so stultifyingly hot. We have to go down four floors to get to Kaibo's, parked in a loading dock area for restroom facilities. And all of this is just kind of wearing on people.
It must be really disorienting to be in a major American city that is so devastated. It's like our image of a third world country where the American planes fly in aid and bottled water, except it's in the middle of America.
Well, the ironic thing was Bangladesh has offered help.
Is that right?
And, you know, that's a country that's subjected to annual floods by itself. And
what kind of help do they offer?
They're offering tea and jute to help, you know, jute for bags, for sandbags and tea. I don't know where that stands right now, but apparently the embassy in Washington made an announcement that they were prepared to provide aid. The Israeli government has offered a water purification plant for Des Moines. A lot of things are happening that are very generous, but it is bizarre being here. Not quite as bizarre as it was when I woke up a week ago Sunday, got a call from a friend. I wasn't aware of the severity of the problem, and she offered. I had some guests staying with me, and she was aware of that. And she said we could all go to her place. She lived in a suburb west of Des Moines, and said we could go to her place for breakfast and showers. And I said, well, why? And she said, well, you don't have any water or power. Sure enough, I looked at my alarm clock, and there was no power, and we had no water. That was the first I'd heard about it. I came downtown, and downtown was one of the most eerie places. There was nobody down here. There were no lights. Walked into a dark newspaper building. There were no computers. Nothing was operating. A bunch of editors were huddled in front of some windows in a corner of the newsroom, trying to decide how to put out the next day's newspaper. And that was a really eerie day, and that continued for a spell. Businesses put sandbags in front of their doors and plastic in front of their doors, and to walk downtown in what normally is a quite active place and to have no activity and have sandbags all over the place, it is indeed like after the bomb or during some war, only there's no gunshots. It's almost frightening and certainly quite a sad situation to be in.
How much water was there in the heart of the city?
The heart of the city wasn't hit. There was an industrial park area south of downtown that was hit. Another industrial park area north and a little bit east of downtown was hit. Some residential damage, severe residential damage in parts of Des Moines and in West Des Moines. I think they're talking like something like 1,300 homes severely damaged in the area, several dozen totally destroyed by the flooding. And to go through some neighborhoods, particularly in West Des Moines, an area of West Des Moines called Valley Junction, you drive by house after house after house, and in front of each house are these piles of what were once prized possessions that are just now worthless, and they're just waiting for the city crews to come up, pick up their old furniture, TV sets, whatever destroyed by the flood. The one thing. A lot of people have the impression that the whole city is flooded, and that really isn't the case, particularly now. The waters have receded quite a bit. Most streets are open and all of that. Most of the city never was really in the floodplain or in danger. And surprisingly, a large number of services are continuing. Movie theaters are open. Most restaurants are now open. Things are kind of back to normal, except for the worst inconvenience, which is just not having water.
No, I know people at the beginning were advised not to go to work, but you had to go to work all along to
right.
put out the paper. What were you up against putting out a paper with no water or electricity?
Well, it meant we had no computers to provide our national, international news or to process the news that we normally generate within our newsroom. We had no production facilities available to us. We had no printing presses available to us. We had nothing. Somebody once jokingly said in the newsroom, well, how fast can you write? Because we were looking at starting from scratch. We were able to cobble together a week ago Sunday arrangements with a weekly newspaper that is operated in Indianola, a newspaper that's owned by the Des Moines Register, and that's south of Des Moines, about 20 miles. And they were able to do production for us on Macintosh computers. We set up a satellite newsroom in a hotel west of Des Moines, and that's where most of the newsroom staffers operated on that Sunday. And then there were a core group of editors downtown just trying to coordinate the whole thing. I wrote an editorial. I wrote it on an old manual typewriter and dictated it to Indianola, where the production crews were. The paper was produced in Indianola, at least the pages. The page negatives were then flown to Iowa City, where the Iowa City Press Citizen ran off 100,000 copies of an 8-page newspaper for the Des Moines Register for I believe it was Monday, July 12th, and that was our flood newspaper. It was 8 pages, no advertising, just all flood coverage, locally generated, no wire copy, no news from outside of Des Moines. That was all we were able to provide.
Were people able to buy it?
We were able to deliver only to the Des Moines area and the suburbs. Our normal daily run is around 190,000 newspapers, and we have quite an outstate circulation, and we weren't able to provide that paper to anybody else in Iowa. It quickly became a collector's item, and we're going to be rerunning that newspaper for people who have requested copies.
What was it like to have so much of the national press in Des Moines while you were struggling to get out your paper?
Well, we're kind of used to that in many respects because of the caucus system, which brings the national press to Des Moines and Iowa every 4 years. So
right.
It's not unusual to have, the National Press Corps flooding the place, pardon the pun. I think it was frustrating a little bit when President Clinton came to town a week ago yesterday because he came to look at our flood and to be, commenting on our flood. And it was a real high, I think, for a lot of the people to see him here. There was some criticism, I know, that, why does the president have to be at every major disaster? But it does give those people who are so frustrated by things, it gives them a lift to know that somebody at the highest level cares and is here. That was a great lift, but it was frustrating for a lot of journalists because, it was nothing for Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw or Peter Jennings or the others to get an interview with the president and be close to him. And the whole system is set up almost more for the National Press Corps than it is for the local press corps.
What does the Des Moines Register look like now?
Looks a little strange. We now are printed on the presses of the Wall Street Journal's production plant. Their Midwest edition is printed in Des Moines. And the Wall Street Journal has a wider web newspaper than the Des Moines Register, so our pages look pretty much the same, except there's this white space on both sides. And some people joke that that's where readers can put their written comments on our reporting. But it looks a little bit unusual. Our deadlines have been moved up. We're not able to get as late-breaking news in because of the need to get the paper out. It's also because the journal isn't able to handle all of our circulation, and we're still using the Iowa City newspaper to print some of the papers for our outstate circulation. And to get those page negatives to Iowa City in time for them to be printed and so the paper can be distributed the following morning, we've had to move our deadlines up considerably. So we're not able to get as late-breaking news in. And we're still providing page after page after page, 16 pages or so a day of flood coverage.
Has the Des Moines Register returned to its regular size?
We're back to our... Yes, we're back to our full size in terms of the
number of
amount
pages.
Of space that
yeah.
we the amount of news space that we have. If anything, we've got more because of the need to tell this extraordinary story, and we're also back to our full circulation. All of our regular subscribers are now getting the newspaper.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dennis Ryerson, editorial page editor at the Des Moines Register. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Dennis Ryerson is my guest, editorial page editor at the Des Moines Register. I know, like in San Francisco and in Los Angeles, people always seem braced for the big one. They're aware that there might be an earthquake. People somehow reconcile themselves to living with that possibility. Is that true of floods in Des Moines? Do people have the possibility of flood in the back of their mind?
I don't think for most of us we did. Certainly nobody thought we'd lose the water system. When that treatment plant was built not far from the Raccoon River, by the way, we get our water from the Raccoon River, they looked at the worst-case flood that they had had, and they added several feet above that when they built the levee system around the water treatment plant. In more recent years, they added on to that. Nobody knew. Nobody expected the kind of flooding we received, which they're now saying was probably within the 500-year flood range, which would mean be the worst flood that you would expect on average within a 500-year period. Nobody expected that. Now, there were some people in the lower-lying floodplain areas that have had flooding in, say, 1990, and a couple of years before that. It hits rather regularly. There is a plan that the Corps of Engineers have put together for a new levee system that would protect a lot of those homes and businesses, particularly in West Des Moines. So those people have become accustomed to it, in a sense. But for the rest of us, there was no way we ever expected anything as bad as what we received. And certainly, again, nobody expected to be without water for 2 weeks, and certainly not without drinking water for more than a month. And that's the situation that we're faced now, 250,000 people without any water for 2 weeks and no drinking water for up to a month.
A lot of people have been saying, well, we're learning that you can't build a city in the path of a mighty river, that the river must have its way. Are you finding stories like that a little bit smug, when they're reported or said by people who live far away?
I think that's true. As one of our columnists wrote, and this came up on one of the network Sunday morning programs a week or so ago, and as he pointed out, these people who are raising these questions are these network stars who make $20,000 in one speaking engagement. Some of the homes in these floodplains are only worth a little bit more than $20,000. A lot of these people living in the floodplains are not wealthy people. They're people of modest means, and they really can't afford to live someplace else. Otherwise, they would. And for them, it's the only place in town where they can find affordable housing. And now maybe in the future, we're going to have to come up with plans that will gingerly help these people to relocate someplace else. Maybe instead of putting this money into disaster assistance, we ought to be putting it into relocation assistance to help these people find housing outside the floodplain and return floodplain areas into more of a natural state where we can use them as parks and public purposes. And when they do flood, then we don't have such huge loss to take care of. But you're not going to pick up the whole downtown of Des Moines and move it someplace else.
As many people have pointed out, the Midwest has had rain of biblical proportions. And, and speaking of biblical, Randall Terry, the founder of Operation Rescue, the anti-abortion group, has been saying that the flooding is the wrath of God. It's
right.
God's punishment for all the abortions that have been performed in the country. I'm wondering if you're seeing a lot of apocalyptic thinking now.
Well, there has been some of that, and I've heard Terry's comments. I've heard other people saying the same thing. It's God's revenge. I find that very ironic because Iowans, of all people, are not the kinds of people who are fast livers. This is not Sodom and Gomorrah here. This is home and family. I mean, Iowa's a place where, families spend a lot of time together, where community means a lot, where church attendance is high. If this is God's wrath, it's certainly unfair to hit upon Iowa of all places. Not that we have a stake on morality in the country. I don't mean to say that. But again, Iowans are pretty clean livers, and I think that's kind of ironic that they're saying now that this is the revenge that we're getting.
I'm wondering if you or people you know are feeling very, very depressed, not just because of all the damage that's been done, not just because of the lack of water and electricity, but also because rain and more rain can really, really damage your spirits.
This has been the lost summer. I mean, people usually don't move to the Midwest for the weather. Winters here are dreary, they're long, and we're in that kind of area. We don't get enough snow where you can play in it and have a lot of fun with it. But we get enough that it's an inconvenience. And so, you kind of just put up with winter. And, you read, you go to movies, you do indoor kinds of things. It's just not an area that's conducive to outdoor winter recreation. And so you live for the summer. And, you hope along about the end of April or May that you've got some pleasant weekends. You can go out, you can bike, you can do outdoor activities of all sorts, play tennis, whatever. And this year, it's never happened. There's no question it's been a real, real downer. People are just getting fed up with it. And then when we had the flood, the first couple days, there was something energizing about it. I mean, this all of a sudden became a great adventure. And it was kind of, in a way, this really sounds ironic. It's horrible for the people affected. It's horrible in some ways for all of us. But in some ways, it provided a little bit of a lift of energy. We could all work together now. We had something really dramatic we had to overcome. And your spirits kind of raise when sometimes you're faced with adversity. But now it's getting real old again, and particularly now when people think, well, we've gone through this. We ought to be able to get some kind of reward. Well, what's the reward we're facing this week? Forecast says 5 more days of rain.
Right. What's your mood like?
Well, I think I'm like a lot of people. I'm just weary. I'm tired of putting up with no running water. I've got clothes that need to be washed. I've got dishes that need to be washed. I'd like to be able to take a long shower. We have RAGBRAI coming up next week, which is the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa. This is an event that's been going on for more than 20 years, and it attracts as many as 10,000 people who start out on the Missouri River and then ride their bikes across the state to the Mississippi. And it's kind of a moving party, a moving happening in many respects. It's a wonderful time for small towns in the state to show off themselves to people from outside the state. It's a great fun event. I'm going to be riding for several days next week. And at one point, there was consideration that we may have to cancel it. But when that great bicycle parade rolls through a town, when you've got up to 10,000 people rolling through a town of 2,000 or 3,000, has quite a bit of impact. And the communities plan for months this event and how they're going to handle it. Not only how they're going to handle it, but how they can use it as an economic boost, because a lot of the organizations, churches, community clubs, and whatever, provide food and refreshments and whatever, and it's looked at as an economic generator for the towns that the bicycle route covers. But I think things like that help. They're talking about several events in Des Moines, concerts. Our AAA baseball team returns to town this week. They've been on an extended road trip. And there was some talk about maybe postponing their return. But as the mayor said, I need a good night down at the ballpark. We need something to have some fun. So I think that's what people are starting to concentrate on now. A lot of people are still mopping up, cleaning up, throwing away things. It's a very dreary thing that they're having to go through. But we're also looking for some ways that we can lighten the load. And I think we need to have that down the path, some way to think, well, we can still have some fun. And that's what I'm trying to do personally. I'm looking forward to going up to Sioux City on Saturday and beginning the bicycle ride on Sunday.
Well, good luck to you, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dennis Ryerson is editorial page editor of the Des Moines Register. We spoke earlier today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's no Jurassic Park, but in its day, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was considered quite a technical achievement. Coming up, we talk with director Richard Fleischer about making Disney's underwater sea classic, and about his father, animator Max Fleischer, who created Betty Boop. And book critic John Leonard reviews The 60s, a collection of essays from 1960 to 72 by Edmund Wilson. It's the last in his series of books about the decades, beginning with the 20s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Supreme Court nominee Ruth Bader Ginsburg says she believes that judicial intervention is justified only when political avenues become dead-end streets. Testifying today at her confirmation hearing, Judge Ginsburg used, as an example, cases where people are shut out of the political process. She also criticized Congress for exempting itself from a federal law banning job discrimination, adding that Congress should set a good example. Her confirmation hearings are expected to end this week, and then the nomination goes to the full Senate for a vote there. Some Republican congressmen are urging immediate disclosure of the findings from the investigation into the House post office scandal. They suggest that any delay gives those involved time to prepare a cover-up. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Wisconsin Republican Scott Klug says any delay in disclosure would give Democrats time to sanitize records and make sure the facts line up. Fellow Republican John Doolittle of California says Democrats are delaying disclosure until after the president's economic plan is passed. House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dan Rostenkowski has been indirectly linked to charges of embezzlement from the post office. If he is indicted, he would be forced to give up his position. But President Clinton and other key Democratic lawmakers say Rostenkowski will continue to be the chief architect of the economic plan as he presides over House and Senate negotiators working to reconcile the legislation. Asked if allegations alone would affect Rostenkowski's role, the president said no and that he expects to continue working closely with him. Rostenkowski says the post office investigation is a political witch hunt. Prosecutors have looked into his stamp purchases and aspects of his financial and campaign affairs. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher has called the situation in Bosnia tragic, but he has ruled out further U.S. actions to stop the killing. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
At a press conference today, Secretary of State Christopher said it was not in the U.S. national interest to do more, rejecting Muslim appeals for outside assistance. Asked if the administration was prepared to accept the fall of the Bosnian capital, Sarajevo, Christopher merely said there are some problems that defy any simple solution. In defending the administration, Christopher shifted the blame onto the Europeans, saying a U.S. proposal to rearm the Bosnian Muslims may well have changed the picture. Christopher made it clear that at this point, the administration is only willing to act once there is a peace accord and only when it is clear the parties are implementing the peace plan. He said the administration is not pressuring the Bosnian Muslims to accept the Serb-Croat proposal to divide Bosnia into three mini-ethnic states. But the absence of any help could well be seen as a form of pressure. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 10 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In New York City, the UN Security Council has decided to keep a ban on trade in oil against Iraq because it says Iraq has not complied with all Persian Gulf War ceasefire resolutions. The move had been expected. Tomorrow, UN officials will speak about Iraq's apparent agreement on long-term weapons inspections. After Iraq invaded Kuwait, trade and oil embargoes were imposed in an effort to force Iraqi troops to pull back. UN Security Council members later decided to keep these sanctions to compel Iraq to comply with all ceasefire terms. The Mississippi River at St. Louis is holding at 47 feet, down slightly from last night's crest, but still 17 feet above flood stage. Mark Minnelli of member station KWMU reports the city is expecting more levees to give way if the water stays at that level.
Tuesday night's crest caused a mile-long breach in a levee protecting parts of South St. Louis from the River De Pere, which normally empties into the Mississippi. Several hundred more people were forced from their homes. St. Louis Mayor Freeman Bosley says the mood in the city is one of uncertainty.
Water we thought had subsided, then it came back up, and people just don't know what to think now. The Army Corps of Engineers and the Weather Service, the predictions and everything is all off, so now everybody's just trying to hope for the best and be prepared for the worst.
Officials say levees in and around St. Louis are waterlogged and fragile and could crumble at any time until the Mississippi drops to at least 45 feet. Meanwhile, the forecast calls for a chance for more rain over the next several days. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Minnelli in St. Louis.
In Moscow, seven people have been killed this week in gun battles. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, rival gangs have appeared frequently, and police say that they are fighting with each other for territory. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In his 40-year career, Richard Fleischer has directed movies in many genres. Action, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Historical epic, The Vikings. Biblical epic, Barabbas. Film noir, The Narrow Margin. Films for kids, Dr. Doolittle and Fantastic Voyage. War film, Tora, Tora, Tora. Sequels, Conan the Destroyer and Amityville 3. And remake, The Jazz Singer. All that plus Mandingo. Fleischer has just written a memoir about his film career called Just Tell Me When to Cry. Fleischer got one of the biggest breaks of his career when Walt Disney asked him to direct the now classic 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Talk about irony. Disney was very unpopular in the Fleischer household when Richard was growing up. His father was Max Fleischer, the great animator who gave us Betty Boop and Popeye. Max Fleischer and Walt Disney were competitors for years.
My father had a running kind of feud with Walt because my father was an early pioneer in animation. He was a wonderful animator. He started his own series in about 1914, long before Walt Disney appeared on the scene. And my father became a big international personality because of the Out of the Inkwell cartoons that he originated. And then Disney came along quite a few years later and started out by imitating my father. And from then on, it was a race between the two animators to see who could become the most popular. And Disney always seemed to be one step ahead through no fault of my father's, but that's the way things worked out.
So what was your first meeting with Walt Disney like? Did you feel like a traitor?
I got a call to come up to see Walt Disney, and it was as mysterious as that. There was no reason given as to why Walt Disney wanted to see me. I couldn't imagine why. I went up to see him, and he presented me with the offer to direct 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and I was really bowled over when I had this offer, and I said, do you know who I am? And he laughed, and the others that were in the room laughed, and they said, yes, we do know who you are. We'd like you to direct this picture. And I asked him why, knowing the background of this whole thing, and he made a little joke of it. He said, well, I saw the picture you made, The Happy Time, that had starred Bobby Driscoll. And then I remembered that Bobby Driscoll was a child actor that worked in some of the Disney pictures. And Walt said, anybody who can make an actor out of Bobby Driscoll has got to be a wonderful director. So I had to acknowledge he was right. And that's how I got the job. However, I made a proviso. I said, I'd love to do this picture, but I really feel I should clear it with my father. I wouldn't want him to think that in some way I was being disloyal to him. So he said, fine, I understand that. You do that. My father at that time was living in New York, and this happened in California. So he said, you call your dad tonight and get back to me tomorrow morning. Tell me whether you want to do the picture. So I called my father that night and told him the problem. And he said, well, by all means, you must do that film. You didn't even have to call me, and naturally you must do that. He said, it's a great opportunity for you. So I was much relieved, and I went with a clear conscience to work with Walt Disney.
So meanwhile, you made 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. You,
yes,
somebody who got seasick very easily.
Yes.
You just spent a lot of the time sick while you were making the movie?
I threw up a lot, yes. I was never a good sailor. I never liked the water, in fact. But I learned to aqualung. I even learned to throw up in an aqualung, which is a neat trick.
Oh,
or
wow.
not such a neat trick. But I eventually got used to it, and I spent more time underwater than anyone else on the picture, including the stuntmen.
Any rough spots you got in underwater?
Well, yes. We had one shark situation, which was very tricky. The scene called for a shark to attack some of the stuntmen who were pretending to be the real actors. So we got a 8-foot shark and killed it. And it's very difficult to kill a shark. It's not an easy thing to do. And we got all kinds of advice on how to kill the shark, which is mainly to bang it on the head with a hammer and then leave it out in the sun for 24 hours. And that should do the trick. So we did that. And then we wired up the shark and aimed it so that we could pull it down a wire right at our actors. And, of course, while we pulled it, the shark revived and started swimming around and breaking all the wires that attached to it and making passes at the actors. That everybody scrambled. Of course, the most dangerous part, was the fact that the cameraman was riding on the back of the shark, and he had the camera tied on to the shark with a rope that had a slip knot, so that in case something did happen, he could pull the slip knot, and release the camera. Well, when the shark broke loose and revived, the cameraman pulled on the rope, but the knot would not release, and he was determined not to let go of that camera and lose the camera and all the film that we'd already shot for that sequence. So we just hung on, pulling on that rope, and then disappeared off into the deep blue. We lost sight of him, and we were scared to death. I was awfully worried. And the lifeguards took out after him, and a little while later, I saw them swimming back with him, holding him up under his arms. And the rope eventually came loose, but not before the shark had dived toward the bottom and the cameraman broke both his eardrums.
Wow. Oh, gosh.
So it was not a pleasant experience.
Was he off the movie after that?
Actually not. He recovered. He spent a few days in the hospital and came back and worked. So it wasn't too bad.
Film director Richard Fleischer is my guest. He's written a new book called Just Tell Me When to Cry. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director Richard Fleischer. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea won an Oscar for Best Special Effects. But the first footage that you shot with the fake giant squid apparently looked really bad, and you had to reshoot it. What was the problem the first time around?
Well, it was what you could call a disaster, because the squid that had been built for the sequence didn't work. It was very primitive, and it would do hardly anything at all. It was manipulated by wires, but it was filled with kapok.
What is kapok?
Kapok is a spongy material that, they use it in stuffing mattresses and
so did it
sometimes
look more like a Muppet or something?
Yeah, but it acted more like a sponge, and it was sopping up water. And of course, this thing was sopping up water, and the squid was getting heavier and heavier, and of course it broke the wire, so we were constantly having to stop and rewire. And then the material that the squid was made out of didn't seem to hold up underwater with water on it, and pieces would fall off or tentacles would fall off. And it was like a Keystone comedy. And I had all these stuntmen out there wrestling with this lump piece of, I don't know what, liver, and trying to make it look real. And, of course, it didn't work. And finally, Walt Disney came down on the set after he'd seen some dailies and film. And he said, we've got a big problem here. What you're shooting is a joke. And why don't you quit this sequence? Go start something else in the picture, some dramatic scenes. And let me consult with the geniuses that I've got working at Disneyland and see if we can't come up with something better than what you have to work with now. So I happily agreed with that. Believe me, I was delighted to get off of that sequence for the moment. But several weeks later, they did come up with a wonderful squid that was now completely automated with lots of electronics in it and hydraulics, and that had a beak that snapped and moved in and out and eyes that opened and closed. And it was operated by people above it with wires. We had about 40 people operating that thing. Puppeteers. But it worked. It worked very, very well. And that's how we got that sequence made.
One of the movies that you directed, you were basically asked to fix. The movie had been in production. A lot of it had been shot, but it wasn't working. I'm thinking of the remake of The Jazz Singer that starred Neil Diamond and Laurence Olivier as his father.
Yeah.
So you were called in to fix it. And one of the things that was a real problem in the movie was Olivier's performance. You thought he was really overacting.
Yeah.
So how do you tell Laurence Olivier that he's overacting?
Well, you had to find... I didn't want to lie to Larry Olivier, but I had to find another truth to tell him. Some things I just couldn't change. It was too late to change. Things like his accent that he was doing, kind of a Jewish accent, which I didn't think was good at all, but he was enamored of it. And since I didn't have time too much time to work with him because his contract was about to expire and he was getting $1 million for the picture, I had to find ways to, when I was, and I redid all of his scenes, every one of his scenes, I had to redo. Because he was way overboard, and I just had to bring him down, that's all.
Toward the end of Olivier's career, a lot of people really wondered, why was he taking roles in movies that you knew weren't going to be very good, when he was such a great actor? He wrote a letter to you after the making of The Jazz Singer, trying to explain why he was even in the movie. What did he say in that letter?
Well, it was a wonderful letter. And he said, you know, there's nothing really wrong with doing something for money. It doesn't always have to be the highest artistic aims, but why not? There's nothing wrong with commercialism. But the real thing, the kernel of what he was saying, the truth of what he was saying, was in that letter when he said, I am concerned about leaving behind me sufficient financial stability for my beloved ones, my beloveds, as he said in his letter. And that was really, I think, the basis of why he did all of these films. So you have to realize, first of all, that although Laurence Olivier was probably the greatest actor and certainly the most famous actor who ever lived, he was not a highly paid actor for most of his career. Most of his career he worked in England, and in England they do not pay actors the way we pay them here. So he never made a lot of money, and it wasn't until he in his later years when he started making films in this country that he'd begin to make some money. And by that time, he had many illnesses. All of them seemed to be life-threatening illnesses. And he was awfully worried about dying and leaving his family without any support.
Right, right. Can I get back to ask you a couple more things about your father?
Sure.
I'm really wondering what it was like to grow up in a house where your father was making these extraordinary cartoons, Betty Boop cartoons, Popeye cartoons.
It was heaven. It was sheer heaven. I grew up in this kind of fantasy world. When I was a kid, my best friends were Coco the Clown and Betty Boop and Popeye, and I was born and brought up in those surroundings. And I spent a lot of time at my father's studios in New York and got to know the artists, and they were always over at the house. We had a wonderful time. My father was a great man and a wonderful human being, and he was terribly funny. So it was wonderful. It couldn't be a better father. And it was great fun being in our household, I must say.
I think it was after the Comic Code came into effect that your father had to clean up Betty Boop and make her less the sexy vamp and more the housewife. How did he react to that?
Well, everybody was very unhappy because, Betty Boop, the whole attraction of Betty Boop is her sex appeal, and it's a kind of an innocent sex appeal. She's very sexy, but very innocent. And, of course, that caused great consternation that the Hays office, which was the industry censorship office at that time, wanted to... Betty Boop always wore kind of mini skirts, mm-hmm. which was way daring for that period, and she wore a garter on her left leg. So they objected to the garter, had to take the garter off, objected to the length of the skirt, had to lower the skirt. Then she wore very low-cut gowns and low-cut dresses, so they had to raise the neckline. And she became kind of a school marm and really hurt the character. And although it did damage the character because of this new and bad look, this Quaker look, there was a great public demand to go back to the old Betty Boop. And so my father defied the Hays office and went back to the old style, and there was no big problem about doing that.
Richard Fleischer's new memoir is called Just Tell Me When to Cry. He's now producing a Betty Boop feature film. This is Fresh Air. It's the second day of confirmation hearings for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on All Things Considered?
We'll be hearing from Nina Totenberg, who's covering the hearings, about Judge Ginsburg's not terribly revealing answers to members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, but Nina tells us the senators seem absolutely pleased to be questioning somebody who they, in almost all likelihood, will vote to confirm for the Supreme Court. Also today, we'll be hearing about Secretary of State Christopher and a new policy toward Bosnia, perhaps, and writer Robert Kaplan about what the United States policy toward Bosnia should be. Also, a collection of writings and letters about the migration of African Americans from south to north earlier in the century.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Edmund Wilson was one of our century's great editors and social and literary critics. Wilson kept journals, which were published in collections, each titled by the decade they covered, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and now posthumously the 60s, with entries from 1960 to 1972, the year he died. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
During the last dozen years of his life, our preeminent man of letters wasn't reading any of the new writers, although he went to many movies, some of them pornographic. And while he clearly despised the war in Vietnam, the author of The American Earthquake and To the Finland Station has nothing to say to his diary about the civil rights and anti-war movements, or the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, or Berkeley, Columbia, Watts, and Woodstock. What was he doing instead? Well, he was fighting off the IRS and worrying about his gout, his shingles, his dentures, and his heart, and lunging after any pretty woman in the vicinity, even his tutor in Hungarian, and even at the Princeton Club, and traveling to Montreal, to Budapest, to Jerusalem, and dreaming about bricks, salamanders, railroads, Robert Browning, incontinence, and abandonment. He also socialized a lot with the likes of W.H. Auden and Mike Nichols, Lillian Hellman and André Malraux, Robert Lowell and Geraldine Page, Svetlana Stalin and Cyril Connolly, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and even Truman Capote, although Edmund Wilson declined an invitation to Capote's infamous masked ball. We learn here that Igor Stravinsky loathed Leonard Bernstein, that Isaiah Berlin has never read Dante or Finnegan's Wake, and that Robert Frost is the most boring writer in America. And Wilson was reading, instead of the new writers, many old ones, like Tolstoy and Balzac, George Eliot and Oscar Wilde, Diderot and Goethe. Learning that Goethe wrote most of the second part of Faust between the ages of 73 and 86, he tells us, cheers him up almost as much as rereading old reviews of his own books. But he doesn't like the second part of Faust any more than he cares for the last chapter of his own life, with its intimations of the flimsiness of human relations, the cobwebs of history and culture, the empty arena where one used to jostle and shout. He recalls what Edna St. Vincent Millay told him back in the 20s, when I had made love to her for the first time in my life to anyone. Edna said, I know how you feel. It was here, and it was beautiful, and now it's gone. And then he drinks another whiskey and eats another Nembutal and dies at age 77, having refused a pacemaker. But I've omitted something else Edmund Wilson did in those 12 years. He also published 12 astonishing books, books of essays and plays and polemics, books on the Civil War and the Cold War and the American Indian, on Canadian literature, Russian literature, upstate New York, and the Dead Sea Scrolls. I find at the end of his journals that I haven't the heart to quibble with his treatment of Mary McCarthy, his defects as a father, his lapses of judgment on Kafka and Colette, his falling asleep in the middle of Pinter's Homecoming. Having discovered, for his generation and for mine, Karl Marx and literary modernism, Edmund Wilson, an atheist and a magician, published more of enduring value in his last decade than all the professors of deconstruction combined will publish in their lifetimes. The day after he died, I wrote the appreciation of him for the New York Times. I felt at the time like Dennis the Menace being asked to appreciate Dr. Johnson or Erasmus. He deserves instead the best, wherever he may be rereading those old reviews.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The 60s by Edmund Wilson. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from grants provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, let's do the twist.
Come on, baby. Let's do the twist.
Chubby Checker had the hit, but Hank Ballard wrote the song and recorded it first. We'll talk with Hank Ballard and with Ron Mann, the director of a new documentary on the twist. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.